The story of Lady Godiva's naked ride through the streets of Coventry has been told many times over the last 1,000 years, each time with slight variations and twists. Nicole Gallen has added her voice to this tradition by reimagining the legend of Godiva in her latest novel. In Gallen's version, the Countess Godiva is a bold and intelligent woman who uses her feminine appeal to influence the powerful men around her. Yet Godiva's insatiable appetite for drama eventually catches up with her, and by the novel's end, she is forced to confront several difficult political and moral conflicts. Nicole Gallen joins us this morning to discuss her novel, Godiva, a novel of love, loyalty, and courtly intrigue. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that description that you just gave.
Well, thanks. Your books are always so fascinating to read. You have such an interesting style. And this, of course, is historical fiction. Mm-hmm. So how much of it is history and how much of it is fiction?
Well, no one knows. Godiva really existed, and she really was married to Erleifric of Mercia, and the all of the historical settings are definitely there. No one knows if the ride ever actually happened, because it was only written down 200 years after it supposedly took place. And it was written, the original version of the story is just so bizarre and peculiar and crazy that one wonders where it came from. I'm pretty certain that the ride, if it did happen, didn't happen the way that it did. But there's two ways to look at history. One is, all right, we don't have a written record from before this moment in time. Therefore, it was invented at this moment in time. The other way to look at it is something happened 200 years before. And then in this historical game of telephone over the years, there was an oral tradition that warped whatever the original version was. And then something was written down, and then it just moved forward from there.
Well, what's a lot of fun about that and being able to do, historical fiction here is you can take that little grain of whatever that possible truth may
could
be and go anywhere.
Yes,
with it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So talk about the process. What kind of research did you do for this novel? And then at what point do you go, okay, now I'm going to fictionalize?
Right. The funny thing about this book, this has never happened to me before, and I hope it never happens again, although it was a good journey in the end. Originally, the novel that I was writing that was set in Anglo-Saxon England was not about Godiva at all. It was about the woman in the book who is her best friend, Edjiva, the abbess of Leinster. And as I was researching that story, which is a very simple, it's a very simple, straightforward story, and that's absolutely in the historical record. Edjiva was the abbess of Leinster. The brother-in-law of the King of England really did carry her away from her abbey, but no one knows if he did it by force or if she ran with him. Mm. And it was that tension. That's a little bit of a spoiler alert, but not too much. So I was interested in the fact that the story got told two different ways, depending on who was telling it, the agenda there. But that wasn't really enough to create an entire novel. So I started trying to fill out her life and imagining what that would be like. And I learned that Godiva was the patroness of her abbey. And all I knew about Godiva at that time was that she was a naked lady on a horse.
Right.
So I thought, well, that's interesting. If there's these two women with these salacious stories associated with each other. Let's put them together, see what happens.
Well, and of course, and if you called the book Edjiva, people be like, who?
Right, exactly. That was so. Godiva started out making cameo appearances in the book, and then the more I researched her story, both the legend that was written down 200 years later, but also who she was as a person and what was happening in the political arena at that time, which had not been as much of a focus when the story was about the religious side of things. She just kept wanting to, there was just more and more stuff to say about her, and she kept elbowing her way in. Mm-hmm. And finally, it was clearly a book about the two of them and their friendship, at which point my editor said, well, I don't want to sound crass, but if you called it Godiva, it would be much easier to market it.
Yeah,
and Godiva herself, of course, was fine with that because she likes to be the center of attention.
Well, it's so funny because we talk about the drama, and that is something that we find in many of your books is a bit of drama.
Yes. Yes. Maybe that's because I have a background in theater. Yeah. So I'm attached to those very high stakes.
Exactly. So what was the most interesting or surprising thing that you found during the research?
There were three kinds of research that I did. The historical, looking through old books in dusty libraries, which is, I love that part of the process. The thing that I realized that I hadn't really understood was how much life changed for women after the Norman conquest, that in Anglo-Saxon Britain, women could be like Godiva, and they could be celebrated for being like that. They owned their own property. She was the one that actually had the power to tax Coventry, not her husband, which is what the original legend claims was going on. They had a lot more power and autonomy. They even had more power in the church. They were allowed, abbesses were allowed to lead parts of the mass, which definitely doesn't happen now.
Right.
But even that was starting to be eroded. And then once the Normans came in, they shifted everything, and women essentially just became property of their husbands and lost a lot.
It's interesting, because I was wondering about the powerful women aspect of that in that time period. So that's interesting. Yeah.
There were fewer powerful women, and the ones, they stand out, like Eleanor of Aquitaine was Norman, but she was really an exception to the rule. So that was one thing. And then the other thing that was a part of that, which surprised me because it debunks the original version of the Godiva myth, is in the original version, the premise of the story is Godiva Rode Naked is a tax protest, which, first of all, is hilarious to me and fantastic. And what a great way to stage a tax protest. I'm not really sure how you make your point,
right,
but it's what a fun way to do it. So the reason that she did it was because her husband, Leofric, was heavily taxing Coventry, and she begged him to stop, and he wouldn't. And she begged him, and he wouldn't. And the original version is very funny because the writer clearly has an attitude about Godiva pestering her husband nonstop. And finally, to shut her up, he says, you know what? If you ride naked through the streets of Coventry, I will lift the taxes. Right. And so she does, and he does, and they all lived happily ever after.
But that's not your story.
But that's not my story, because the thing I learned is that the Anglo-Saxon... the way that Anglo-Saxon society was set up, Godiva herself was the only person with the power to tax Coventry.
Yeah.
That's a power that 200 years later she would not have had. Her husband would have had it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So what drew you to this particular story?
I think there's something innately scintillating, if that's the right word. I want to say titillating, but that may be going too far in a particular direction. When you hear about a naked lady on a horse, that's just, you know, you sort of like, if I saw a naked lady on a horse, I would certainly look twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the narrative sense, that's what I was doing. And, oh, you'd asked what went, going back for a moment to the surprising things. One of the things I did for research that I've never done before was when I had done all of my cultural research and material culture research and geographical on the ground research and in the dusty libraries, I said to my husband as I was finishing the final draft, you know, I actually don't know what it must have been like for her to be naked on the horse. I think I need to ride naked on a horse. And he said, yeah, I think you better. Can I watch?
So you did.
So I did.
Oh, wow.
I did,
but you didn't ride through the streets.
I didn't ride through the streets. Yeah. Although no one saw her riding through the streets.
Wow.
Her husband made sure that no one could see her. That's in the legend.
Except for the Peeping Tom.
No, you know what? That came 600 years later.
As another addition to the story.
Yes. One of the things that I love, that I also love about the story of Godiva, is there's a fantastic little book called Lady Godiva, A Literary History of the Legend by Matthew Donahue, I think his name is. And I love it not just for what it says about Godiva. I love this sort of research in any subject. He tells the story in its different iterations over history, and you realize that each teller of the story, and it's not just whether it's the legend or the movie, it's also artwork that's done, songs that have been sung.
Right.
Every version of it is written to appeal to the audience of the time.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, so when you were talking about the art of it, I'm thinking of some of the sculptures that I've seen. And, you know, sometimes, you know, she's riding up there very proudly. Other times she's sort of huddled in shame.
Yes.
It's really, all these interpretations are really very interesting.
Yes. And it's always about who your audience is, or who you are, as you know, in that moment.
Right.
So it's just, I believe that in general anyway. I don't think that there's such a thing as an objective master narrative, even to history itself. How history is told is always subjective, even when we think it isn't.
Mm.
But her particular story, just to me, is a really, really clear example of that.
Right. But you said you started out thinking that this was going to be a story about Ejiva.
Mm-hmm.
So what attracted you to her? I mean, because that's where you started with this,
yes,
right?
Yes. I've always had a fascination with this premise that there's no master narrative and that there's always different ways, different sides to a story. And when I was writing my first novel, The Fool's Tale, there was this couple, this wonderful eccentric couple in Leinster, England, which was very near the area where The Fool's Tale takes place. It's on the border between England and Wales. They didn't even know me. I only had contacted them because they were, he was a specialist in medieval Welsh music and I needed to talk to someone. And he happened to be near where I was, so they invited me for dinner. And they were questioning me and they wanted to know like what my plans were for finishing the book. And I didn't really have any. I was broke. I was breaking up with my boyfriend. I didn't have a job. And they said, well, why don't you just stay here and live with us for a month and finish writing the book? Which was amazing. And while I was there, as well as being a tremendous resource for the book that I was writing, they also had that same pride in local history that mm-hmm. we do on Martha's Vineyard, right. that I'm sure you do on Cape Cod. So they started telling me these stories. And Maureen's favorite story was, well, do you see that church there? That church has been around for 1,000 years. And it used to be the centerpiece of an abbey, and the abbess was carried off. But some people say, and other people say, so it was the fact that there was no definite version of the story.
Tucked that little morsel away and came
yes,
back.
Yes, and then I came back to it years later.
Because I think The Fool's Tale is probably one of my favorites of your books. I loved that book. That book just whisked me away to another time and place.
Thank you. Yeah, I did that to me too.
It was really a lot of fun.
An obsessive experience.
So what is it that attracts you to historical fiction as a genre?
I feel like I backed into that somehow. Again, with a background in theater, one of the things that I really love about theater that's harder to translate to books is there's a willing suspension of disbelief is the conventional mm-hmm. term for it. But you can exist in an indeterminate time. The story is the most important thing. So you can do Hamlet and you can set it in any time period. And it's not about that time period. It's about the story. Mm-hmm. You can do it set in no particular time period with everyone wearing jeans and black t-shirts, and it's still the story. And what I was drawn to originally with The Fool's Tale was the story that is the relationship between the three main characters, which I liked to characterize as a lowbrow Camelot. Instead of a king, a queen, and a knight, it's a king, a queen, and a court fool. Mm-hmm. And then I needed a setting for that. If you were doing it as a play, you don't have to have a setting. Right. It could be in a total abstraction. And if it was a setting, it could be pretty much any setting. It could be a fantastical setting, but it wouldn't be labeled as fantasy. It mm-hmm. would just be a play about these three characters. When you're writing a novel, you have to be more specific. So I thought, well, obviously, if it's a king, a queen, and a fool, it's got to be medieval or Renaissance. I wanted it to be in Wales just because I wanted an excuse to research Wales, because I love Wales, which none of my English friends understand, but that's another topic. And so then I literally moved backwards in time until I found a period in Welsh history when that story could take place. Mm-hmm. And then since I researched that era as well as I did, I thought, well, I might as well...
Might as well stick around here
might
for
as well
a while.
Stick around in this era for a while. So the next two books were set within a couple of years of that, different parts of the world, but...
Right.
But the same period. Mm-hmm. And then by then I had developed the muscle of researching and writing based on what I learned.
Mm-hmm. You enjoy the research part of this.
I do. At this point, I'm starting to feel a little like it would be okay to take a break from that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm a nerd by nature.
So is that, you know, sort of time period something you've always been attracted to, or it just because you happen to be looking for that setting
for
The Fool's Tale?
There's no particular attraction to it. The one, Iago, which was the last book, I definitely, because of my Shakespeare obsession, that was definitely
that
something
was
that I was more drawn to.
That was really a lot of fun. All right, so in this novel, Godiva is an outspoken and powerful woman who uses her good looks to charm the men into giving her what she wants. And you mentioned women had more power, but does this boldness that she have mm-hmm. accurately reflect women's position at that time that the story takes place? I mean, were they that bold?
I think it's hard. I think that the way that I've depicted her makes her somewhat exceptional. Mm-hmm. But they definitely were. It was okay to be a bolder woman culturally then than it was 25 years later after mm-hmm. the Norman conquest.
And the confluence of Christianity and paganism is central to your story.
Yes. And that was a really happy surprise. I didn't. In the research that I had done just for Edgeva, I had focused just on what was happening in the Catholic Church at that time. And then once it expanded to sort of what was happening in the world at large, I began to encounter all of this information that implied that the official line that the church gives us, that Christianity was simply in place in England by that time, and that in fact there's something that is called Celtic Christianity, and that even that had died out by then. I just started getting little bits of evidence that that was not actually true. Mm. And there was one thing in particular that I stumbled into. There's a book by Bill Griffiths called Aspects of Anglo-Saxon Magic. And I picked it up because I thought it would be interesting to read about healing tinctures and stuff, because the abbess is a healer. And that was the only reason I picked it up. And I kept discovering this stuff that if I had read it somewhere else, I would think, oh my God, that's one of those like neo-pagan, like make it up as you go along things. But it was written down 1,000 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
So
all these little gems that come across, you know.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun.
So was this coexistence of these two different types of spirituality harmonious or antagonistic, do you think?
Among the common people, it was harmonious. It was absolutely. There's a scene in the book where Godiva is asked by the people of the hamlet of Coventry to participate in something called the land ceremony charm, which is 50% church and 50% pagan. But the church completely is on board with the paganism, which is not what you would guess from hearing that. So I think that among the common people, it was absolutely harmonious. But among the nobility, because the nobility had to deal with the church hierarchy, and the church was learning to flex its muscles and trying to control how things functioned. I mean, Rome was really gearing up for being the extreme force that it became 100 years, 200 years later. And so the nobility and the ruling class had to be a lot more careful about what was known and what wasn't known about what their beliefs were. They had to toe the line in a very public way.
Yeah. So Abbess Ejiva makes an appeal for King Edward to abolish a tax that funds the mercenary army that protects the king from his own subjects. Talk a little bit about that, this mercenary army.
Yeah, the right before, I probably should have boned up on the craziness of the history that predates the story. In the 11 years before the story takes place, England had been through 3 different kings and several invasions, and none of the kings were the son of the king before him who died peacefully. They all either took it by conquest, or it was understood that they had to be the next person in line because of some very complicated political maneuvering. And the king in the story is Edward. He's been on the throne for 3 years when he starts. And he ended up being an okay king, a little bit weak. He never had children, which is part of why William the Conqueror could come in and do what he did. But at the beginning of Edward's reign, he was a very weak monarch, and the country was very unstable because of what had happened before. So there was, in the era of the Viking raids and the Danish raids, and everyone's raiding everyone else, and people are killing each other, and it's the dark. It makes Game of Thrones look tame. During that period, one of the monarchs, I don't remember who it is offhand, and I don't want to pretend that I do. I just don't remember. Created this thing called the Herregeld, which was a tax that he imposed on the people of England to raise his own army that he could then use to protect himself from the people of England. Yeah. And he used it for other things. Originally, it was also he wanted to invade Scandinavia, and so he was taking the money from the English people who weren't really interested in Scandinavia. The tax was not all. It wasn't an annual tax. It wasn't always imposed, but in a way that almost made it more tyrannical, because it meant that the king could just impose it whenever he felt like it.
Yeah.
Right. And Hartha Canute, who was the king before Edward, was very into imposing the tax. He did it. He did it a lot. He used it to, when he showed up, tell me if I'm getting too medieval geeky
on this. It's great.
Okay. So when he showed up, and this is in the intro to the book, so I try and make it as clear as possible. When the king before him died, it became clear, not because of hereditary elements, but because of a combination of political and lineage, that he would be the person that sort of had to take over, just because he was just the best choice for the job. No one was happy about it, but they accepted that he would be there. But when he came to England, because he was Danish, he wasn't English, when he came to England, he showed up as if he was going to have to conquer. He had this whole fleet of warships that sat off the coast of England. And
intimidating.
No one, yeah. Right, yes. And then even though he didn't need them, he kept taxing the people to pay the soldiers to stay, not go anywhere.
Just in case.
But yeah, just in case, exactly. And it was very unpopular, and it was very heinous. And not only did the common people not like it, but the nobility, the ruling class, didn't like it either, because it everyone had to pay that tax before they could pay any taxes or fees or tolls to their immediate lords,
right.
The earls and the counts and the barons. So
nobody liked it.
It was very unpopular.
So one of the things when you're writing a story like this, and you've done all this research and you've got this historical part of it, even though we don't know the whole story, there are parts of the history that we do know. So how does that play into your character development? You've got people who are real, and then, of course, you bring in these characters who you can do anything with because they're not real.
Right. Well, actually, everyone in the book is real.
Is real, okay.
But what we know about them isn't real. So we don't know that Godiva made the ride. We know that Ejiva was carried off by Swain. We know that all of those characters must have known each other, but we don't know what their actual relationships were, except that Swain definitely...
So you get the political... I mean, you get, sort of this license to, kind of...
Yeah, yeah.
Make these relationships that may or may not have existed.
Exactly. Yeah. So I know that the Herregeld existed. I know that it was very unpopular. I know that Ejiva was the abbess. Her feelings about the Herregeld, I think, were probably accurate because I think everyone felt that
way. Nobody liked it, yeah.
Right. But the degree to which she was outspoken about it, that's my invention. Mm-hmm.
So did you have fun with that then? I mean, being able to say, let's see, I think, nobody likes this. I'm going to, how can I have these, like Godiva and Ejiva, be childhood friends and being able to create those relationships?
It's a lot of fun. And because there's a part of me that's such a purist every time that I'm taking a creative license, not in that I'm changing history, but that I'm making up stuff where there are gaps in the history. There's a part of me, like, my high school history teacher or something going, are you sure about that? Can you substantiate that?
Check it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun. And I think one of the unexpected experiences I had writing it is that I learned how American I am. Because the things that irritated me and the things that I celebrated and supported and the things that I wanted to put into the story were very much a product of my being a modern American. And one of the things that I think makes a lot of my writing different than the prototype of what historical fiction is supposed to be like is I don't mind doing that. I'm perfectly comfortable doing that. And again, I think that goes back to the theatrical tradition where the point is not to be Shakespeare's history plays are written for Shakespeare's people, not to document what must have happened back then.
Right. So you mentioned that you sort of feel like you need to take a little break from this area, this time period. So have you started on your next book? Have you thought about where you're going with it?
I'm in a transitional period, and I'm actually I can't go into this in more detail, but I'm finishing the final draft of another medieval story that I'm writing under a pen name. For complicated reasons.
Okay.
And that has been so research intensive under such unusual circumstances that I will really be ready to be done with research.
Right.
There's a couple of projects that I'm thinking about that are contemporary.
Hey, I was going to say, have you thought about doing something in present day?
Yeah, I have. And I'm playing around. I had an idea for one story that I'm not going to pursue now that was going to be set on the vineyard. Then I have an idea for another story that would also be set on the vineyard, but I'm not ready to let that out of its out of
but
its cage.
But you're toying
yet.
With the ideas and gathering, because you always have those the little morsel, like when you're there in Wales finishing the Fool's Tale, and you get this little tidbit.
Yes,
we hear this from writers all the time, and they just sort of tuck that away.
Yes, you bookmark
it. And you tuck it away, and then at some point, it's like calling to you. You know,
it
says,
yes.
"Hello,
hey,
remember me?"
Right. Yes. Yeah. So there are some projects, one of which actually is historical, but I don't know that it would. That it wants to be a novel, I think it might want to be something else. So yes, I've got one of those going on, and then there's other things. I'm in a place right now that I'm not always comfortable with because I like knowing this is what I'm doing for the next year and a half. I'm just working on this one story, and I'm not there right now. But I am also aware that the discomfort is necessary for the next stage to evolve. So I'm embracing the discomfort.
Nicole Gallen, her book is Godiva, a novel of love, loyalty, and courtly intrigue. Always nice to talk with you, Nicole. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.